Let me start by thanking Perry for her very generous suggestion that I have some responsibility for NEA BPD, an organization which has had enormous and still growing influence in the country by making available conferences like this, which broaden everybody's awareness and depth of information about this disorder that we're all concerned about. I'm the last person on the program. I'm aware that that means that you've already been inundated with a lot of information and probably looking forward to a Saturday afternoon elsewhere. And what I would welcome is some interaction during the course of this discussion, lending itself and leading into a more open discussion. I think partly with that in mind, Perry suggested I take on some broad title. I kept lobbing out more specific things, and she said, "Well, you're at the end, you know, just the diagnosis, and then, you know, say what you want to say." And so you get a sort of a hodgepodge. And in fact, when I looked at the slides I'd set in, they didn't really make a great deal of sense. That there were replications, and there was no obvious order to it. That had to do with the fact that at the time that I was sending these in, my secretary and I were engaged in a battle over preparing new slides and what numbers. And she'd enter one, and I'd be working off one copy, and anyway. So there's some coherence to the slides that are in front of you and what I'll use to guide the talk, but forgive the inconsistencies. This was one of the most recent losses this morning when I was changing the order of the slides. Much of the content of this one disappeared. And you probably can't read it. What it says is historical trends in the borderline construct, and it starts out by saying that the construct began as a form of personality organization, really derivative from Kernberg and other psychoanalytic thinkers, where our classification system at the time, the whole classification system, was very primitive. And the discussions in a field of psychiatry and mental health, which was dominated by psychoanalytic paradigm, had to do with whether people were psychotic or neurotic. There were no normals. Then there is this group that didn't fit into either of those categories. And so borderline personality organization was posited as one of three major forms of personality organization. And if you start thinking epidemiologically, I mean, that would cover a huge sector of the general population. What brought the borderline construct to attention was the idea that a severe and a group of people with personality disorders were potentially treatable. And, of course, at the time, the hope was that very intensive, long-term, heroic treatments, which were enormously expensive and where it was really not something anybody could do any place other than in major academic centers, could bring about some kind of curative change. And that impelled a whole lot of enthusiasm by a generation of clinicians that would not otherwise have ever brought this disorder into the attention it gets now. That was followed by some effort to define the syndrome. Roy Grinker, who was at the time the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Chicago, did perhaps the first and most pioneering effort. And that was followed by the work that I did that actually started to identify criteria which differentiated these people from other groups of people, and that in turn led to its adoption in DSM-3 in 1980. And with its adoption within the official nomenclature, a large number of empirical studies... Oh! Well, so there are additions to this one, but they're probably still unreadable, so here we go. We'll move on. This reflects the remarkable growth in both clinical and research reports about borderline personality disorder. And these were all sort of what I would now call first-generation research. Mary made reference to some of those which had to do with longitudinal course, which had lots of dropouts and were methodologically weak. And that was true of almost all the research which was done. And it is refreshing and quite remarkable to hear accounts like Mary's and Pat Cohen's earlier today about the depth and precision of modern research and the degree of integrity and believability about the results that was unmatched by this early generation. Amongst the major findings that have come out of the research, I'd like to highlight two. One is the one you just heard about by Mary. Her findings about the overall course of borderline personality disorder took place against the context of this. There had been a number of studies, this is one by Mike Stone, which suggested over a long time borderline patients got better, but that it was a very stormy course. Most of the more notable thing about this is I think like a 10, 12-year course. And now we know that the rate of recovery is frequently much more rapid than that. This is another prospective longitudinal study, which the collaborative longitudinal study, which Mary was also part of, which just simply highlights what she was talking about, the rapid decline in the number of symptoms over even the first few years. The second major, I think, change in our understanding of the borderline construct came from the identification in 2001 about the fact that borderline personality disorder has significant heritability. Just as it was sort of assumed for a long time that borderline patients was a stable disorder, intractable to treatment, it was also assumed that borderline personality disorder was largely, if not exclusively, the result of environmental causes. So the idea that when Sven Tergesen and his group suggested there was a very high heritability to this really has called for a very different understanding of this psychopathology. The comments earlier this morning by Scott Wilson, I think, are reflective of a new generation of and a new type of research, which is promises to have very long-term effects that follow up from this finding. In the meantime, we're left with the idea that borderline psychopathology has significant heritability, and what is it that's inherited? One of the prospects is that there may be something about the inherent neurocognitive wiring of borderline patients, which something like splitting, which we've always thought of as an interpersonal phenomena, might be reduced to something that's genetic. On a more descriptive level, the general understanding of borderline psychopathology is that it's divided into three major sectors of psychopathology, each of which can be understood as phenotypes, meaning the subsyndromal phenomenology of the disorder, which has significant heritability. And that's this way, the affective characteristics of borderline patients, their readiness to become angry, anxious, or to shift between anxiety and depression, which are specifically the aspects of their affective lability that are most characteristic of borderlines, may have an underlying genetic basis for it. A second phenotype is their impulsivity or behavioral dysregulation. Here, their tendency to act without concerns for long-term consequences And maybe specifically their behavioral specialty of self-injurious behavior may have a significant heritable component. And the work that Scott Wilson described earlier this morning underwrites that possibility. And thirdly, and this is the area that I'll dwell on a little bit more, is that the interpersonal characteristics of borderline patients may have a heritable basis. This really flies in the face of most psychological and certainly psychodynamic thinking about borderline patients, because this is an arena that has always been thought of as something that has been environmentally created and perhaps environmentally amenable, as opposed to something that for which there might be some genetic underpinning. This slide I won't dwell on. It's simply a little more information about the impulsive phenotype. I had another slide that was supposed to be here on the affective phenotype, but neither of those are central to what I want to talk about. And since the affective phenotype is missing from my slide collection, I'll just slide over this one. This gets closer to what I wanted to talk about, which is that when you begin to think that the interpersonal characteristics of borderline patients may have a genetic basis, this is supported by sort of a long line of research, which I knew nothing about, which indicates things like interpersonal warmth may have a significant heritable component. Even in the work that comes out of academic psychology about personality traits like agreeableness, that has a significant heritability to it. Within the realm of borderline personality disorder, there's been a lot of concern about the early attachment experience of these people, and most of the emphasis has been in the attachment literature as well as in the standard psychoanalytic literature that there has been something very dysfunctional in the early parenting of people who grow up to be borderline personality disorder. If you turn that on its head and become more aware of the degree to which the parenting experiences are conditioned by the nature of the child, things which have been hinted at by several of the speakers earlier today, you begin to see something that is far more interactive. And this slide something captures about it. If you have an infant, for instance, who is unusually easily distressed and maybe particularly sensitive to the interpersonal interactions with their caretaker, they are more apt to have distressed responses to, let's start with, normal caretaking experiences that involve frustrations and disappointments and hunger or needing attention, but that their responses are more distressed to those normal things than another child's. At that point, if you have a distressed response by the caretaker, it's going to aggravate that child's predisposition, and they will become more distressed and more fearful. A distress-prone mother, caretaker, is likely to respond with anger or withdrawal. What happens then is the attachment to the caretaker becomes what's called disorganized. Disorganized attachments, I think I have a slide. Oops. Here we go. Our contradictory and unintegrated behaviors towards caregivers when comfort is needed. The slide says this occurs in the first year in about 15% of infants. It's identifiable actually by 6 months. I think it's 5%, but it may be 15% of infants have this. It is associated, this comes out of a literature not specifically related to borderlines, but looking at early attachment experiences between infants and their caretakers, with hostile and helpless caretaker behaviors. And this gives ways to controlling strategies by 6 years. And what some of these children who have disorganized attachments to their caretakers then go on to form either caretaking relationships with the caretakers so that they become parentified, something which I think in Mary's work she identified about 30% of the histories, childhood histories of people with borderline personality disorder. And it is actually an adaptive way for children who have disturbed caretaking experiences to stay in touch with and keep their caretaker alive. So within the realm of sort of Darwinian adaptation, is it actually a very a resourceful adaptation made when you have caretakers who have problems. I was thinking of that this morning when Pat Cohen talked about the fact that a significant number of the children who at 5 years old had had, who went on to develop borderline problems, had had severe separation experiences from their caretakers in the first 5 years of life. And that, interestingly, it was not simply the separations that she said, it was separations which were, where there might have been some attribution of will on the part of the parent, as opposed to those which are due to medical illnesses. So that there was a certain, which takes you into the meaning attached to the separation as much as just the separation itself. In any way, you can imagine a child with a parent who is absent for any reason becoming a caretaker for such a parent. And it's an adaptive way to keep that caretaker alive and keep them involved. And maybe one of the pathways which lead to later borderline personality. Another way, which might be more comfortably familiar with adult clinicians of adult borderline patients, is that they can become quite punitive towards their parents and become sort of hold them hostage, a pattern that you can see evident when they get into the adolescent, early adult years, where you see parents who are intimidated by the threat that their child is going to either misbehave or kill themselves or overeat or undereat or go out all night or whatever it is, and they become held hostage by these threats of the child. That also is an outcome which is predictable by these early disorganized attachments. Go back to my overall thesis is that there may be issues within early development which set the stage for later development of borderline personality disorder, and that those interactions are twofold. The child helps create the parenting as much as the parenting creates the child. And the pre-borderline child, it's posited, has an innate hypersensitivity that shaped the early caretaking and predisposing to make later interpersonal stressors particularly traumatic to them. One of the issues with parents are that they may often bring the standard literature about parenting has always been that the parents are creating the child. And I know when we raised our children, we always felt responsible for shaping them. And unfortunately, I think that we were imposing too much responsibility on us for their outcomes, and not enough, we weren't sufficiently aware about how the child, the children differed in what they needed. And in fact, our responses to them appropriately should have been more and should be shaped by, as much by what the child's particular needs are. And this is a, I think, good paradigm for use clinically, that to talk to parents about the fact that they have a child, borderline adult, who should be seen as a special needs child, the sorts of responses that might have been, you may have been raised by and proud of, and or that might work with other children, need to be modified, that these are children who some of the instinctive responses that you might value highly can be harmful for. Some examples of that are, these are children, young adults, adults, who it's generally not a good idea to give "you can do it" reassurances to. If that offspring is borderline, they'll hear that as you're saying that I'm responsible for not having done it, that you underestimate, don't understand how hard this is for me. And so it's a basically well-meaning, well-intentioned response that might be good for many other people, but when you're dealing with a borderline offspring, it's not a good thing. It's just another vignette along those lines with the borderline patients often said to cause splitting, and we heard an example earlier today about how that may be something that the borderline person participates in, but it takes an environment to create the splits. So with parents, you know, it is not unusual for parents to be somewhat divided in their roles. Typically, but not always, the male is the person who sets the rules and reinforces them. The mother is the person who does the nurturing and the reassuring. When you have a borderline offspring, those things which are generally fine in most families and work out well for raising children, can be the soil which is very fertile for creating splits, and where those same characteristics can bring about acrimony within the family, and that is very harmful both for the parents and for the child. So we would counsel parents in general when they have a borderline offspring, before they respond to the demands, requests, behaviors of their borderline offspring, they talk to each other and they reach some consensus about what they both agree. It doesn't really make any difference whether the answer is going to be yes, no, or something in between, but that it come from both of them so that there's not inconsistencies between them. Because inconsistencies in the parents are very fertile soil for them to develop their psychopathology. If the father is usually the one who says no, let the mother say no. If the mother's usually the one to say yes, let the father say yes. So these are very directive, explicit types of customizing the home environment to diminish borderline psychopathology. I'm not sure what my next slide is going to be, so okay. In the background of what I'm saying is my own bias in the direction of understanding borderline psychopathology. I feel that while the case could be made, as I think DBT proponents would, that emotional dysregulation is the core psychopathology, and there's much that can be said for that. The argument can also be made that the behavioral discontrol is just as core and maybe more important. I would think that the interpersonal hypersensitivity, or the arena of interpersonal relationships, is where the core psychopathology of borderline personality disorder is. The affective phenotype helps explain the comorbidity with mood disorders and maybe especially bipolar disorder. I was very interested in Pat Cohen's data along that line. The impulse phenotype helps explain the overlap with substance abuse, bulimia, and antisocial behaviors. But the interpersonal phenotype is the arena I think that most distinguishes borderline patients, which makes them so identifiable and why they are so unforgettable, both within the family lives of that they come from and within the treatment context where we see them. They are very interpersonally intense, charged, demanding, and interesting, and evoke all of our hatred and rescues. Efforts at the same time. I want to turn now to some issues that surround the borderline diagnosis. One is the fact that most clinicians are reluctant to convey the diagnosis to patients. There are many reasons for that, not the least of which is reimbursement. If you identify the person as bipolar 2, which is now the most, in Boston, the most common diagnosis, but that has followed upon PTSD or major depression as being the leading diagnosis, there's some reimbursement that you can count on as clinicians by giving those diagnoses. They also reimburse for sort of more limited types of treatments, which are not likely to do justice to or be very specific to borderline patients. In any event, many clinicians, the only, well, the study that I know best is one out of Rhode Island outpatient clinic where only one out of 40 borderline patients actually had the diagnosis identified in their charts. I think clinicians often recognize the diagnosis much more than one out of 40, but they're hesitant to put it into the official records that surround it because of reimbursement reasons. There are other reasons too, which is that if you give some other diagnosis, particularly an Axis 1 mood disorder diagnosis, you have a treatment which is relatively easily done and which is more upbeat in its tone. You got this problem, I've got a solution. Doctor feels good, patient feels hopeful. Medications generally don't work very well. When they don't do it very well, what you see is what Mary described, is that the medications multiply. Borderline patients are not so much a problem with compliance as with their eagerness to find a solution that is that simple and the gratitude they have for a doctor who offers that kind of hope. So the doctor gets intoxicated alongside with the patient by the hope that medications are going to do something. The medications multiply, the patient gets worse, not better. On some level, there's more despair on the part of the patient and their family because the treatment which they had counted on isn't working. And then, of course, the worst tragedy is what Mary just described with the polypharmacy and those patients who don't get better, and there is an interactive effect. It's not like the medications caused it. The proliferation of medications is symptomatic of the fact that the patient wasn't getting better and symptomatic of a problem in the mental health field where there was not a willingness or an ability to step back and say, treatments aren't working. So medications, if they have a role, it should be empirically tested. You know, this might work. If it isn't, let's take it, discontinue it and try something else. And specifically, borderline patients and their families should be told that the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. There are only a few instances where another diagnosis should trump it. I think, for example, people with substance abuse need to be sober and have some stability in their sobriety before their borderline personality disorder can be treated. But that's really the only clear exception. I would also, and maybe it doesn't need to be said, but people who are psychotic with bipolar 1 or that also would trump it. But in the arena where we oftentimes actually make our decisions, like if somebody has bipolar 2, that ought not to trump borderline personality disorder. Bipolar 2 is equally ambiguous in terms of its responsiveness to medications and particularly mood stabilizers. And yet, that's a perfect example of how the cycle of expectations and can get linked to a psychopharmacological treatment where even the clinician who knows about the treatment of bipolar 2 would want to anchor their comments about the use of mood stabilizers. If with bipolar 2, you can't expect. The results are very unpredictable. They're partial and sometimes not very good at all. That does not mean that borderline personality and bipolar 2 are not linked. They are, but they are linked in this way too, that there's an ambiguous and partial response to medications. In contrast, what we now know about if you understand borderline personality disorder and offer the diagnosis to patients and their families, the prognosis changes dramatically. One of the reasons why this diagnosis has such a bad name is that for the first 15 to 20 years in which it was used, the only literature about it in the treatment arena was psychoanalytic, and what they did is not document successes. They documented how hard the people were to treat. And partly they were so hard to treat because they were being treated with something that was iatrogenic. It made them worse. And we're still getting over that. And the mental health field in general has not turned around its attitude about understanding that this is a good prognosis diagnosis. It is with a complex, significant heritability behind it in its etiology, and where the treatments are available, which are very optimistic in their effectiveness. I think Jim Payne, maybe Perry, I don't know how much has been said about the initiative this last year when the Congress passed a resolution. Has that been discussed? I wasn't here yesterday, I'm sorry to say, but it's a remarkable development where the United States government takes an initiative which should have arisen within the mental health field to say that we, our country, our people, need to be more aware of a disorder which is highly prevalent in our society, very destructive to family life, very costly in public health terms, very under-recognized and under-diagnosed, and often mistreated or made worse. And this initiative should have arisen within the mental health field. Indeed, I think we're going to have to be dragged by our bootstraps back into an awareness and a sort of treatment attitude that is responsive and respectful of these patients' needs. The American Psychiatric Association in this coming spring is going to give a nod in that direction by identifying a significant part of the scientific program or dedicating it to the kinds of research you heard about this morning. The American Psychiatric Association's primary journal, the American Journal of Psychiatry, is going to dedicate the May journal to articles about this and to improve awareness. That is a start in that direction. All of you who are part of the mental health community here in Minnesota can do a lot locally in terms of advocacy and publicity for a disorder that you're here because you're interested in, but you're also aware is often underdiagnosed, and certainly your treatment efforts are hazards to your reimbursement for them. So with that overview, I'll close and we can have an open discussion. Thank you very much.